Welcome. This is the Fly Fishing Journeys podcast with host Rob Giannino, where we have great conversation with really awesome experts from within the fly fishing community. You see, the fly fishing lifestyle is a journey, and we're glad you're on this journey with us. Check out flyfishingjourneys.com for more podcasts, and please subscribe on your favorite podcast player. Here's your host, Rob Giannino.
On this episode of the Fly Fishing Journeys podcast, we have a very special guest, Simon Gosworth. Simon is the Education and Engagement Manager for Farbank, the parent company to Rio Products, Sage, Reddington, and Flywater Travel. Simon is acknowledged as one of the world's leading authorities on spey casting and has taught and demonstrated spey casting around the world. But his expertise doesn't stop there. In this podcast, we cover Simon's beginnings outside of London, England, when his father, a fly fishing instructor himself, taught him how to fly fish. As Simon worked with Rio Products in product development for many years, I wanted to dive into different types of fly lines, and we talked about the process of making a fly line. We finalize on a wonderful deep dive discussion on the makeup of both mono and fluorocarbon leader and tippet material. Simon's insights here are invaluable for any fly angler. Helping me on this podcast is my friend Phil Rowley. Phil, who was also born in England, has a nice friendship with both Simon and Rio, so was kind enough to sit in and add value on this episode. Enjoy, and please check out both our recent and coming podcast. We have recently posted some great guests and have many more coming soon, so please hit that follow button and stay tuned. Thank you. Before we jump in, I want to let you know about the new travel section we have on the flyfishingjourneys.com website. Our goal and what we are passionate about is being on this fly fishing journey with you. That's why we go to the fly fishing shows and why we have started group travel with you. For the last 2 years, we have brought select friends and listeners to Iceland for curated hosted trips. We continue that with 2 weeks in Iceland this year, which are sold out, and 3 weeks in Iceland in 24, which are starting to fill up. These trips are pre-vetted for the best weeks on the best rivers. All the accommodations and details have been thought out and handled for our guests' convenience and enjoyment. This July, my good friend Tim Kamisa and I are headed to Alaska for some salmon fishing in the Bristol Bay area. I head back to Alaska in August to experience 2 additional lodges, new rivers, and different runs of salmon. July is more kings, chums, and sockeye, where August the target is silvers. Our goal here in Alaska is similar to Iceland, getting you the most hands-on current information. We don't have any Alaska trips to offer in 23, but stay tuned for more information for 24. Back on another episode of Fly Fishing Journeys podcast, and we're excited to have both Simon Gosworth of Rio.
Thank you.
And professional author fly tire and fly fisher Phil Rowley on the show. Guys, thanks for being on our show.
Good to be here.
Yep. The two stooges that we said.
Well,
we started,
that's kind of how I'm going to program it. Well, the reason I wanted to ask Phil, we've actually done a podcast with Phil. Really, we wanted to get together with Simon because we haven't had you on. So thank you for being on, Simon.
First time being on. Thanks for asking me.
Yeah, my pleasure. And we want to go through your history a little bit about how you got started in fly fishing. I want to go through a lot of the Rio lines specifically and maybe some of the tippets and some of the accessories. And now you guys have flies as well.
Yeah. Very excited by that.
Yep. And I want to go through some of that specifically. Specifically on the lines, I use Rio lines, very dedicated
cool,
to the brand. I enjoy the brand, but I want to talk a little bit about how you make a line, and we'll get into something that. And then you have so many different kind of specific lines, I think more so than other brands. You know, you get very specific on the lines, so we want to talk a bit about that. So before we get into the lines, why don't we talk a little bit about how you got started in fly fishing? What kind of brought you into the sport?
Oh, yeah, that was the easiest thing in the world.
Yes.
My dad.
Okay.
I mean, a lot of people learn from their dad, right? Or a grandpa or something. But my dad, when I was 6, he started a fly fishing school. So what else was I going to do?
Wow.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
That was his business. So he kind of left his job in the UK, was selling computers for Honeywell, some giant computer thing. And he got fed up with the rat race of that. And he'd always fished. And his professional life, headmaster at a teacher, a school of maths and physics is what he taught. And so when he got fed up with the selling the computer thing, he said, all right, you know, what do I do? I fish. What do I love? Teaching. I mean, let me teach fishing. And so he started a fly fishing school, and it was about when I was 6 or 8, actually. Probably 8. It was eight, actually. So scrap that first.
That must
bit.
Have
it
been
eight.
That must have been really cool to be a young 8-year-old lad and have your dad. Now you're in the UK. I didn't actually preface that. You were born and raised in
In England,
just outside of London.
I was born outside London, a place called Kent, which was kind of one of the home counties.
Okay,
and then we left Kent to go down once the school got successful. Problem with Kent is it's in an area of England where there's not any good trout rivers or salmon rivers. So my dad wanted to expand the school to an area that had trout rivers and salmon and these sea trout and things like that. So he up the family and we moved down to what's called Devon, the West Country. And that's a nice area of the UK that's got trout streams and salmon in them and lakes. And so he could teach all forms of fly fishing, not just lake fishing. So that's why we moved.
Okay.
I was about 12, maybe 13 when we moved to Devon.
To Devon?
Yeah.
And how far is that from London?
It's probably a 4-hour drive.
Okay.
Something like that. And then, 5, maybe.
And then, Phil, you're actually born in Liverpool.
Yes.
So
never
you guys have this camaraderie here with Team Liverpool.
Of course. Liverpool.
Go Reds.
Yes, we won today. 1-0. Beat Everton, crosstown rivals.
Yeah. One of the big derbies, right? You always have these intense derbies between teams in all sports, right? So Liverpool and Everton are two professional football teams in the UK that the stadiums are half a mile apart. They are that close.
So they're head-to-head.
And Liverpool are their home is the previous Everton stadium. So these are always tough rival games. And so today we won.
So you're a young 8-year-old boy. Your dad's teaching fly fishing. And you just, how you gravitated to it. You just loved it.
It was awesome.
Yeah.
I mean, what else can I do? Right? My dad wants to go. So he had the same... And I have the same philosophy with my kid, is that if he wants to do it, he can join me. He didn't pressurize me into
it.
But we lived on a house in Kent that had, that had a pond.
Yep.
And the pond was about half an acre, 3/4 of an acre. And in the pond, we stocked a whole pile of trout. And the trout were swimming around.
Yep.
And what else is there to do except go and catch them?
Yeah, yeah.
It's awesome.
It's good. And then tell me about like your teenage years. Tell me.
I moved to Devon.
Okay.
Right, and the West Country. So much prettier. Just countryside, out of the cities and out of the smog and away from, I mean, I love lake fishing. I've always lake fished all my life. But now I had the opportunity to learn about river fishing. So we moved to Devon and my teenage years were just, I call them misspent years because I didn't chase girls or drink, which was really odd. My teenage years, I just went
fishing.
That's
when you're supposed to do that.
Apparently so. So it's misspent. And so I loved casting. I loved casting and I loved fishing. And so every moment I left school, I'd be straight down to school playing fields casting. My dad set up a tournament casting club in the UK and got lots of kids and members in. And so we had all the equipment. We had the targets and the distance ranges and the platforms and all those things. And so we had all the gear that I could go out and practice. And, you know, there's like anything you do. If you practice it that much at that age, in that 13, 16, 17, 18 year age, you're going to be good.
Yeah.
And especially if you love it as much that you want to practice, not that your dad says, you must go and practice.
Right. You were trained for it.
There was nothing else to do.
Yeah.
Before we jump back into the podcast, here's a short word from one of our fantastic sponsors. Are you a guide, a lodge, or a product manufacturer in the fly fishing or outdoor industry? I want to introduce you to and highlight Cross Current Insurance. Their entire team are great people and experts in their field. They have a guide insurance program that is amazing and very affordable. If you are a lodge or retailer, they also have programs tailored to your needs. These guys fish and are in the outdoors, so they know the industry and the landscape. To get more information on a program that's perfect for you, find them at crosscurrentinsurance.com.
Now, did your dad do other things besides the school, or did he went full-time into the school?
No, he went straight. That was all he did, just had the fly fishing school, and he grew the school, expanded the school.
We're learning the history here, how he became the master.
Yeah, he was. He expanded the school, and then because in the UK the schools are seasonal, right? The fly fishing is seasonal, so you have, probably Canada's the same. Right? Well, you have fishing all, you have
we
fishing
do,
the winter.
Yeah, our seasons are more governed just because winter.
Yes. We have a closed season.
Yes, and there are some fisheries that are closed, particularly the rivers and streams.
Yeah, so everything in the UK shuts. When I was growing up as a kid, 30th of September,
done.
Fishing is over. Course fishing going on, right? So you could put a couple of maggots on and go and catch some tench.
Right.
Never got into that stuff. And so from the 30th of September onwards to the 15th of March, there was no fishing.
Okay.
And so my dad realized that they had to have some kind of income in the winter. And so he then moved and bought a hotel in Devon where we were. And in the winter, he offered shooting,
like
hunting, shooting classes. So he had a shooting school. and people would come down and learn shooting, or they would take out what's called rough shoots or keep driven shoots, or you know, there's lots of shoots. So we had fishing in the winter, in the summer, and shooting in the winter. And that was his year. I was never a shooter or a hunter.
Did you go to college?
Nope.
Never. Okay. Now, how did you come over to the U.S.?
Well, it's funny, your story, right? Because the U.S., these are the paths of life.
Please.
That kind of wander around.
The wandering paths of life. Yeah. Simon Goldsworth.
Well, I'm sure everybody's got paths that do the same. One day, I taught a guy called Bo, and he was spaycaster.
You were teaching him.
And this was at my dad's hotel, and Bo went over to the Dean in Canada and started spaycasting in the Dean, and it was in the 80s, late 80s, mid-80s. And there was few people spaycasting. And when he was fishing the Dean, he was spaycasting. One of the guests on the Dean was this guy called Jim Vincent. And Jim Vincent started Rio. And Jim saw Bo spaycasting. He goes, "What is that? Where is that? And how do I learn that?" And Bo said, "Oh, you should speak to Simon." And so we conversed. Obviously, we contacted. I went over in 95 and fished with Jim in Canada. And we become friends. And then I'd go each year. I'd fly over and teach a couple of classes for Jim and with Jim on spaycasting. And at that time, I had my own school. My dad had retired, and I had my own school. And at that time, I had the seasonal thing. So every winter, I would stop teaching, and I would find some shit job and pump gas or some bad job. pumping gas, working hotel receptions, all those kind of things. And I had the worst job of all was this paint factory.
Oh, no.
And I had to go in there, and these are the 12-hour shifts. And I had this little box painted in concrete. And it was a 3-foot by 3-foot box, a concrete floor. And met the box with the yellow lines. And I had to stand in this box. And you stood in this box because there's this robotic system that came around, conveyor belt thing. It came around and stopped. And on this conveyor belt was this long post, and it stopped in the center of the box. And so I had to stand in this box, and it stopped for about 15 seconds, and I had to load up this box with these shelves, you know, these little thin, I don't know if they're steel or aluminium or whatever they are, these little shelf brackets that have two lugs that click and they're thin metal, and they got a little turned up nose. So I had the raw metal ones of those. I had 12 seconds to load this up, and then that would move off, and the next one would come in. And that was the most soul-destroying job I ever had.
I can imagine.
Unbelievable. And luckily, at the time, I was consulting for a travel company called Frontiers, and you know, they're a US company, but they had a UK headquarters.
Right.
And they set up a lodge in Argentina on Tierra del Fuego in the Rio Grande, and they phoned me up and said, "Simon, would you like to spend the winters guiding for this enormous sea trout, or do you want to do the paint job thing?" Okay, yes. Guess what?
I know what I'm going to do.
I'm going to change my life here.
Yeah.
And I wasn't married or anything at the time, so I went down, spent my 4 months in the winters guiding down there, which is brilliant. And then
tough.
A little bit of wind.
It's so windy down there. We had wind. There's another story because we don't have time for podcasts. The strongest wind I've ever been in my life. Was blowing 90 miles an hour because we had a little wind thing on the thing. And we had a Frenchman. And that combination is a story which is hilarious. I can't tell you because it's just time-wise. But anyway.
We'll get back to podcast number two. We'll get back to the next podcast.
The Frenchman in the wind.
The Frenchman in the wind.
Not with wind.
In the wind.
Probably had it, but
you wouldn't have known it.
The way he had waders on. You would certainly have known it.
He would have.
For a while.
So my third season there, I was dating this girl, and we got engaged to get married. And we set the date to get married, and she said, "When we get married, you can't go to Argentina. So you can't spend 4 months away from me. That's just not right." And I totally understood it. And because I was still doing these classes with Jim, I was chatting with Jim and saying, "Jim, my wife wants me to stop guiding. I don't know what we're going to do. I've got to have a proper job." That's what her word is, get a proper job.
Proper job.
And
my wife is saying the same thing.
Get a proper job, will you? And so Jim said, "I know a proper job. Come and work for me at Rio."
Okay.
And so the next winter I went out on my own because he said, "Before you say yes," because everything sounded great. He said, "You've got to spend one winter living in Idaho. See if you can handle it. Is it brutal?"
Yeah.
And it was pretty bad. But it wasn't that bad.
Was that where Rio was founded?
Yes.
Idaho.
Yeah. Idaho Falls.
Idaho Falls, exactly. And so this was probably the winter of 98/99 that I went out there and did this trial, a couple of months or weeks, whatever it was. And then we moved out. My wife and I moved out in 99 full-time to work.
99?
Yeah.
Phenomenal. Now, where were you when Jim ran into the guy who was spaycasting?
Cabo? Oh, I still have my school.
No, where was that?
He was on the Dean in BC.
British Columbia?
Yeah, the Dean River.
Yeah.
Yep.
So that's where Jim and Bo met. Sorry, I've had to make that clear. Jim and Bo
met there. Ground.
And Jim just saw this spade casting thing and wanted to learn, and that's why he got
So
that
where
to
did
me.
You teach Jim?
Well, we just converse mostly on the phone and written letters, right? There's no email those days.
Okay.
And then I flew out in 95.
Oh, so you actually flew from England to Canada?
Yeah, to fish with Jim. Yeah.
To teach him how to spade cast?
Yeah. To fish, ostensibly, and it turned out to be teaching.
Okay.
So I knew it would be.
And then Jim ran, had his friends with this gentleman, and that's how we saw that he was spade casting.
That's
and then
it. Saw the spade casting, he loved
Simon.
It. Yeah. And then he got into spade casting. And as I said, then I would fly out the next couple of years. I would fly out to UK to the US, sorry, and teach spade casting classes with Jim.
Okay.
And that's as he was setting up Rio.
Amazing.
And at that stage, Rio was only making hunting journals, believe it or not, bass journals, sticky waterproof labels, and hand-tied leaders.
You were there from the beginning.
That was before I started. Then he started making
fly lines. Yeah, but like the lines and then,
yes,
that's really
where I got in right
there. The explosion of Rio, you saw the whole thing.
Yep.
Why don't we jump into the fly? It's an amazing story, and I talk with you all day. I know you have, a booth to get to, so I appreciate you taking some time with us. But why don't we talk about, how a line is created? That's what I'm fascinated by. How do you make a line? What's it made of, and how do you make it?
It's very, the simplest thing. I don't want to hog this. I mean, Phil's here.
Never mind. Pretend he's not here.
He's a parrot.
Most people do. I'm a parrot. That's gonna stick. You're Simon's parrot.
He's had his own
sitting
podcast.
On my shoulder. Okay.
Your show.
I don't feel so bad then. So a fly line has a core.
Yeah.
Right. So there's two components to a fly line. A core, which is the center part. That's the strength. That's the structural strength of a fly line. And then there's the coating that surrounds it, and that is the weight and the density. And the coating has no strength, so if you remove the core, you could break a fly line at about 6 ounces. Yeah, pop, 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 pop. Mm. So the core is the center part, and the core offers some stiffness to it, some rigidity to it. So there's piles of different core materials, and there's piles of different coatings, but in the simple layman's term, you have a core, and the easiest way to think of a core is like a braided backing would be one type of core, right? It's a braid of multi-filaments.
A thicker braided backing,
Or thin, right? So some of our lines have cores of 12 pound and 15 pound. Because they're really thin lines. They've got to have a very, very thin core.
Okay.
You can't have a thick core with a thin fly line, right? So a line like a Euronymph line, which is super, super thin, it has to be for the style of fishing, is going to have the thinnest possible core. And therefore, if it's thin, it's going to be slightly weaker. So it's going to be about a 12 or a 15 pound long strength fly line.
Okay.
So that's your core. That's your strength. And then the coating is basically, the base of a coating is PVC, polyvinyl chloride. That's the liquid plastic.
Okay.
It's the liquid we get it in. And then we add ingredients to it. We'll add tungsten to make it sink.
Okay.
Because in its own natural state, if you made a fly line out of PVC, it would be a clear intermediate. And so that's all you would get. You would get a clear line, and it would be an intermediate line.
Interesting.
So if we want to make it a green line, we have to add green. Right? And if we want to make it sink, we have to add some tungsten.
It's a clear liquid PVC.
Yep.
And that would be just the fly line if you didn't do anything to it.
Yep. Well, it's the liquid. It's one of those chemistry things. The liquid's white.
Okay.
But when you cook it, it goes clear.
Okay.
All right, just to keep it simple.
Oh, the liquid comes in white.
Yeah.
And then you cook it, it becomes clear.
Yeah. Yeah. And then we add tungsten. So if we want to make it fast sink, we'll add lots of tungsten, slow sink, a little bit of tungsten. Hover, you kind of balance this tungsten and the microspheres, the things that make it float. There's these little glass balls called microspheres, right? And they are used in the fiberglass industry. And we pour those in because, again, in its natural state, it'll sink about 1.5 inches
like
a second.
Like an intermediate. Okay. Yeah.
So, again, if you want it to sink slower, or if you want it to float, you have to put in something buoyant. And that is what a microsphere is, a glass ball, a hollow glass ball.
Microsphere.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Tiny.
And so how do you get the diameter? Like, what do you pour it into to create the line?
Yeah, so that's very, very interesting, right? There's essentially two ways to make a fly line. And it all depends on your base plastic, PVC or polymers, polyethylenes, polyurethanes, like that stuff. With PVC, they are cured in an oven to dry out. It's a visual you have to kind of imagine. Right? Imagine there's a core that is being rotated right here. So there's a machine winding, and there's a core, a big bobbin of core here, and it's winding. And between these two, there's lots of pulleys, and there's an oven with pulleys in which everything cures. And then before the oven, there are hoppers of PVC mixed to whatever color, density, whatever we want. And the tube feeds this liquid PVC onto the moving core.
Okay.
And it goes through a variable orifice, a die type of thing, a scraper.
Okay.
Right? So let's say, for example, you want a double taper 5, right? Just a nice easy line. A double taper 5, the body diameter is about 50 thousandths of an inch. This is why it's easy to remember fives, all the fives. So if we're making a double taper 5, this hole shrinks to 50 thousandths of an inch.
Like an aperture almost.
Like an aperture. Yeah, exactly. And it scrapes the line to that diameter.
Okay.
Right? And then if we want to put a taper on it, that iris, that aperture, will shrink to the next diameter you want. Right? And so it starts to narrow it down to create
over
the taper.
Over time.
Yeah.
When it goes through, it's got to go over time to create the taper.
Exactly. So a double taper 5, 50 thousandths in the body, 36 thousandths in the tip. If we want a 10-foot taper.
Right.
Right, let's say a line runs about 10 feet a minute, which is about an average time for a line to be cured in the oven, 10 feet a minute.
Okay.
So if we want a 10-foot long taper, over the course of 1 minute, that thing will shrink to the size we want.
You get to time it.
Yeah.
It's all about the timing
as
well.
So that's how you create your tapers. Right? That's all PVC lines are created that way. That's the modern way. The old day was rotating cams, inaccurate, no ability to create sophisticated tapers that there are these days, what are called compound tapers.
Compound, yeah.
But these days, you can create these compound tapers. So we can tell our computer, if we wanted to open and close and make a bump, right? A
That's what I was curious about, is how you create those bumps and over the tapers, and like if you're going to do a bass taper or like a saltwater taper with thicker, how that
That's
happens.
It. Exactly on that.
It's
you
on
just change that
so each
system.
Line, the computer has all the formulas that's in there, you plug it in,
that's
and
it.
The machine responds to that and builds the line to those specifications.
That's it. That's all
incredible.
It is.
In video, we call that keyframing.
Yeah. Okay.
So we tell a keyframe, if I want a picture to start here and then go here, I just create like keyframes. And
okay, that's
so
a great analogy.
Over time, this is the size at this time period, this is the size at this time period, which is bigger, and then the computer will just grow it to that size over the time, which sounds similar to the
that's
way
a very way, a good way of picturing it. Because that's how your tapers are created. And fly lines are created as a long rope of fly lines. You don't make one line.
Right.
You make this long rope.
Okay.
And between each line, let's say we're making 100-foot lines. Usually a skein of lines is about 1,500 feet long.
Yep.
So if you're making a 100-foot line, there's 15 lines coming off on one giant rope. Between each fly line, we tell our computer to open the iris and close it and put a lump. And so our coilers, as they're winding it up, feel the lump. Chop, and they know that's the end of that line. It's 100 feet,
that's
and
incredible.
Chop it off. So that's how you get your individual lines off these giant skeins.
That's wild.
We're going to take a short commercial break to hear from Tim O'Neill of Norvice.
What makes the Norvice different than another system?
There are a lot of rotary fly tying vices out there. The Norvice is the only vice that will truly spin when you tie flies, and there's a big difference between rotating a vice slowly and spinning it at a bit of a faster RPM. And being able to spin the hook on a zero axis rotations opens up a lot of doors for us in the world of fly tying.
Tell me about the introduction of colors to the Norvice system.
When we obtained the company from Norm, he said to me just a very, very short statement. He said, you know, I always thought a colored Norvice would be a cool item. We brought out five colors: Radical Red, Sunset Orange, Shamrock Green, Liberty Blue, and Royal Purple. We have five colors along with the black that you're accustomed to seeing with Norvice, and we've been doing very well with those.
To find more information and their online store, visit nor-vice.com.
Is there a number of how many different types of fly lines that Rio carries? Not that I'm putting you on the spot or anything.
You put me
like
on the spot. Why did you tell me to do my homework? It changes so much. There is obviously a number, but it's a lot.
I know. Well, because I only ask because Rio seems to have a much wider selection of styles, of specific unique styles within trout, within salt, within spey.
It's a conscious decision, right? Because Rio got into the fly line game way after anybody else, right? SA was there and Cortland was there. You know, they had these old established fly line companies, and it's very hard to get a tow in and get a fly shop to carry an unknown fly line.
Mm-hmm.
Right? It still would be hard these days to do that. And so how Jim started Rio on the fly line business, or how the fly line, Rio fly lines got into shops, was creating niche fly lines that nobody else made. Spey lines to start off
niche with. Fly lines.
Yeah.
That's what I was getting to.
The wind cutter fly line, right, was the first true fly line that Jim designed and made. And it became the first, because he was such a passionate spey angler, he designed this, and it was the first line designed for spey casting. Before that, it was double tapers. Anglers only used double tapers for spey fishing. There was no spey line.
Right.
So he creates this wind cut. He designs a spey line. And suddenly people start going, wow, this is actually so much easier to use than a double taper. Mm-hmm. So he started to sell that. Then he did the same design in the trout line. We came out with the trout wind cutter. Do you ever remember that? Did you ever use that? Yeah, I'm sure you did. And so he designed these niche lines that nobody else had. So that's how I got in, right? The shops could sell their Cortlands and SAs. You know, the Cortland 444 Peach has always been the best-selling line in those days. And so they would have that in. But every now and then they would say, oh, you've got a windy day, or you've got to have this wind cutter because this line will cut through the wind way
better. Interesting. Yeah. So that wind cutter really separated Rio from a lot of the market because it was a unique niche line. Yeah. And a lot of the lines were just general way forward or double taper.
And now, of course, that's expanded. Like, everybody has these niche lines.
Yeah.
But funny enough, Chris is our R&D guy, and he's here at the show with me. And we're sitting at breakfast this morning, having a little conversation and talking about a new line idea that we've been testing and playing around with. And I said, so what's the latest on this line here? He said, you know, I think we really should bring this out. We won't sell many of these, but it's, you know, there's a hardcore user who would like this line. I'm not giving you any hints because there might be spies in this building.
No, they're all there.
Watching and listening. But, and by the time this comes out, maybe it's out. But anyway, so the idea is that we don't want to just make the mainstream lines, right? We do want to make mainstream lines that everybody buys because, of course, that's the bulk.
Yeah.
But we all are so hardcore, passionate fly fishers that we want anglers who want the edge, an edge to have these lines.
And I think that generates kind of a brand loyalty because you have all these different styles
and
niches.
With crazy people, yes.
With crazy
people. All the crazy geeks who want to do something different.
Well, we know.
The crazy Stillwater guy.
Can you do this?
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yes.
And that's, but, you know, the money's not there, right? The money is in your Wake Forward 5 Rio Gold line. It does everything. You don't need any other line.
Yep.
That's your main line, and that's where you sell the volumes.
Right.
But again, the following people who do these niche things, like Phil says, go, oh, Rio has these niche lines.
That's really cool. And, you know, I think that's when you can, the chef can kind of get in the kitchen and work his magic, and kind of the wizard can kind of create all these new little niche lines because you can just kind of plug all those data into the computer, right? And then make it all happen.
Yeah.
So I'm sure there's a lot of research and development to try to get these different bumps, as you will, papers.
Oh, there is a long, long process. You know, that, as I said, so we're 2 years into testing this line out. We've got a few product testers here in Colorado that have been working with us, and I've been casting them, and the buyers are casting, and some of our ambassadors have been using these lines. And, you know, so there's a process of testing them out.
Right.
And do they do what they're supposed to do? Can we make them better? And we'll get to a point where, all right, this is about as impossible to get any better. We'll launch it. We think we're going to sell some. We then got to persuade the sales team that they're going to sell them.
Sure.
You know, they'll still come down and say, we're not going through 2 years of development for a fly line we're going to sell 10 units off.
Sure,
it's not worth it.
We're going to talk a bit about tippets now. I want to talk about leaders and tippets quickly. We have a few minutes left.
All right.
And we're going to take a quick commercial break, if that's okay, Simon. And we'll come back and talk about leaders and tippets, and then we're going to close. How's that sound?
All right.
Simon, thanks again for being with us. We had to excuse Phil. He was off to some class or something. What was he doing?
I didn't think he made it very clear. I think he was just an excuse. He wants to go and watch the football. He wants to see the highlights of the game.
He wants to go have a beer, I think.
Yes.
So we want to close, but before we do, we want to talk about leaders and tippets.
Yeah.
And I want to talk specifically about, we can't get into all the nitty-gritty, which I love to talk about, like diameters and euro-nipping. Maybe I can request a podcast, too, or a follow-up down the road. Would that be okay?
We can request it, sure.
It can be requested. It depends on how this one does.
Exactly.
I want to talk about the differences between mono and fluoro. Mm. I'm sure that's a popular question for you. And when would I decide to use mono? When would I decide to use fluoro, specifically in the leaders, but more particularly in the tippets?
Yes. So monos and fluoros, right? There are monos are blends of filaments, of poly numbers. Right? There's a whole bunch of materials that go in to make a monofil. Right? All monofils aren't the same.
Okay.
Right? A lot of people just say mono and fluoro. There's way, way more than that.
Okay.
Right? Because you get monos. And the easiest way to look at it is you can look in a catalog like that, and you can look at four different materials, and you can take those four materials, all mono, for example, and take four materials that are exactly the same diameter. One of them will break at 4 pounds, one will break at 8 pounds, one will break at 15 pounds, and they're all the same diameter.
I've heard this.
And so right there should be a clue that mono isn't just mono. There are... That's a huge subject in its own right.
Okay. That monos have a whole podcast just on monos.
You almost do.
Yeah.
Right? And in a nutshell, and I know we're running out of time, and short, is that you can't cast a heavy big fly with a supple nylon, right? You want a nylon that's stiff enough to turn over a big fly. So you want, there are stiff nylons designed to be stiff. The ingredients that make those stiff nylons make the nylons weaker than the suppler materials. And so I might have a stiff nylon that's this thick that breaks 8 pounds, but it's going to turn over a big, heavy thingamabobber, a big stonefly nymph, a terrestrial, a big streamer, because it's a stiff material.
Yep.
And I could get the same diameter supple material that's lovely and soft and get much better presentation in the water, but the properties of it, the ingredients of it, will make that thing 15 pounds, for example.
Okay.
Right? So the nylon isn't just nylon. That's the first thing, is that there are, why do you look at a catalog, whether whoever's it is, Umpquas, Rios, whatever,
yep,
and you'll see that there's so many different nylons. That's because you want to choose stiff nylons for throwing big flies, supple nylons for throwing soft tackles and presentation, stuff like yep that, and just a general purpose nylon that has a bit of everything.
Yeah.
Now you get to fluorocarbons, and fluorocarbons are, the first thing to know about fluorocarbons is that they have a very, very long life, right? They have a half life of something like 10,000 years. So they never degrade, right?
Okay.
So monos degrade with UV. So all your monos will degrade. And a general rule of thumb with monos is that the really thin diameters, anything under 5X, thinner, like 6X and thinner, you change every single year. You don't even bother keeping
saving
that spool
it
in the second year. It loses too much percentage.
Mono
of
or fluoro or both?
Mono.
Mono.
Monos. And then 5X to about 3X, I'd probably say you would change that every second year. And then the thicker materials, they're thicker. There's a little more structure to them. So you can keep those quite a bit longer. Fluoro doesn't ever degrade. So there's no weather system. There's no UV
right
that degrades that. So your fluoros will last a lot longer.
Even in the X to 6X, 7X?
Yeah,
okay,
yeah, absolutely. They don't degrade. The weather doesn't affect them. So that's one positive.
Okay.
Another positive of the fluoros, or difference between fluoros, is that their specific gravity is different, is denser than
right
mono. And density is all a function equivalent to the number 1.0. So the bigger the number is above 1.0, the faster that thing will sink.
Okay.
Right? So if I have a 1.1... that'll sink at a certain speed. A 1.2 density, specific gravity, will sink quicker.
Right.
0.9 floats.
Okay.
0.8 floats higher, right?
Okay.
So that's a gravity, specific gravity density thing. So fluorocarbons are more dense than nylons, so they sink quicker. But nylons are denser than water, so once they hit the surface film and break the surface film, they also sink. So one very, very, very common misbelief is you can't use fluorocarbons on dry flies, because they say it'll sink it. Absolute baloney.
Baloney.
Oh, absolute baloney.
I don't have to beep that one.
You don't have to beep baloney. That's why I said baloney. I was going to say something more.
I know you were.
Baloney. I fish fluorocarbon dry flies all over the place, all
okay
over the time, the small dries, because, again, the fluorocarbon will sink the dry fly once it breaks the surface film, as will a nylon.
Okay.
But it won't sink a small dry fly because there's so much surface area holding the dry fly up. There's no way a fluorocarbon will pull that down. So that's one thing you don't have to worry about. And more than anything, when you're fishing dry flies, especially with spooky fish in clear, calm conditions, you want every edge you can get.
Right.
And it's almost ludicrous that people don't fish dry flies with fluorocarbons in those conditions, because that's absolutely when you should.
Well, you want it to break that water, too, because sometimes
right
with the
there's
mono,
that
you've got that line on. If it's spooky water, you can visualize almost that line a little bit on the mono.
Until if fluoro breaks the meniscus,
right,
it will not sink. So
right
you'll do that with fluoro, and that'll also sit on the surface film. But what the difference is the light refraction index.
Okay.
And what that is, when you put those two materials in water, and I have a little display at home, fascinating little display. When you put those two items in the water, and they are exactly the same diameter, you will not see the fluorocarbon in the water, and you will see the nylon in the same diameter.
Right.
And that's the light refraction index.
Yep.
So fluorocarbons are far, far less visible in clear water. That's why you use the fluorocarbons. They're also tougher. They're
stronger,
a lot more abrasion
yeah
resistant.
Right. Yes.
Right. So if you're doing a lot of bottom bouncing and snagging rocks and things, there's a lot more abrasion resistance on that. So that's another reason for fluoro.
Okay.
But generally speaking, it's in those conditions where you want the ultimate edge because the water's clear and the fish are spooky.
Yep.
The Fly Fishing Show Tour travels the country every winter. From January until March, the largest consumer fly fishing shows in the world will be in one of six locations. The regular stops are Marlborough, Mass., which covers the New England area, Edison, New Jersey, which is the New York, New Jersey, Mid-Atlantic States show, Atlanta, Georgia, Denver, Colorado, Pleasanton, California, the Bay Area Show, and finally back to where it all started in Pennsylvania at the Lancaster Show. These shows are super fun events that are packed with teaching, presentations, and everything you could ever want to know or see in fly fishing. Find all the details at flyfishingshow.com.
Well, we could dig deep, yeah. And I hope we can again. I know you guys have the fly lines, you have the leaders, you have the tippet,
yep.
You have some accessories.
Yeah, a few little accessories.
And you have the flies now.
And we have our wonderful flies.
Now,
yes.
When did this idea about Rio getting into flies come about?
The idea came about probably 2-3 years ago.
Yep.
And then, there's always these steps and these processes. We have to do a market study to see if there's a demand for flies. We have to make sure we got the right people to design flies.
Yep.
There's a whole process going in. So about 3 years ago, I guess the idea came about. And really the idea, our kind of how Rio talks and sells itself is we make the connection. And we're the connection from the rod to the fish. And the missing component was a fly.
Okay.
Right? We had the fly lines, the leaders, the tippet, and everything else.
Now
like
you
that.
Got
the last component is the fly.
It's interesting.
And again, because we all fish, we all throw in the ideas, what are the patterns we need? We know these patterns for Idaho.
Right.
So that's our
like
connection.
That. Make the connection.
Yeah.
I like that. Are you direct to consumer in the flies, or you go to the fly shop? That's what I'm curious about.
So everything is available online on the website, but the problem is that the moment like flies are sold in dozens.
Right.
So you're not going to go to Rio and buy a dozen size 12 parachute Adams, a dozen 14, or not many people. We only
right.
sell them in dozens.
In dozens.
And so most of those flies are going to the fly shop. People can, if they need a dozen,
they
absolutely.
Buy them a dozen, they
you can get them off the website and
yep.
buy them that way. But most of that goes to the dealers who then split them up into the bins and can
okay.
sell them individually.
I think many people know, but in closing, maybe for those who don't, Simon, can you give us that 30-second elevator kind of pitch on the relationship between Rio and Reddington and Sage?
Yeah, very simple. It is the head company is called Farbank.
Okay.
And Farbank started by buying Sage in 1980. That was the first company. It's owned and operated, or was at this time, owned by Jay Green, who's just a passionate fly fisherman. And so he bought Sage in 1980. And then they bought Reddington, I think it was in 2000. It might be in 2001, but there or thereabouts. Then they bought Rio in 2005. And then they bought Flywater Travel, which is a travel company in Ashland, Oregon. This one company owns these four brands.
Yeah.
And it's created a lot of good things for us because we have a collective pool of resources, of people and money to market and work together. So, for example, when Sage are designing a new rod, they'll say, this is what the rod's going to be, and we'll
yep.
design a line that with the Sage designers to try and get the lines to match as good as possible. So there's that benefit from it as well.
That connection,
that
making
connection.
The connection from the rod to the line.
Yeah.
I like that. Well, it's been an absolute blast and a pleasure to have you and an honor to have you on our podcast.
I appreciate you asking me, Rob.
And I wanted to talk on this one a bit about your more personal story rather than all the products. But
yeah.
we do have some other stuff to talk about maybe in the future, like the space stuff,
yeah,
the Scandi and the Scatter.
Oh, yeah.
Maybe we can have a version 2 of the Simon Goldsworth podcast.
We possibly could,
We
yes.
possibly could. Well, thank you for being on our part. And before we close, Simon, how can people get a hold of Rio? Was there an Instagram or a website?
Yeah, there's standard social media. There's a Facebook, there's Instagram, there's all those. And it's Rio Products.
RioProducts.com.
It's just not Rio, it's just Rio Products. So if you're on Facebook, you've got to go Rio Products. If it's Instagram, it's Rio Products. But yeah, or RioProducts.com.
Phenomenal. Thanks for being on our show, Simon.
Thanks, Rob, for asking us.
You've been listening to Fly Fishing Journeys with your host, Rob Giannino. To be notified of new episodes, subscribe on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, or Google Podcasts. You can follow us on YouTube, Facebook, and Instagram. For past episodes, check out flyfishingjourneys.com. Fly fishing is a journey, and we're glad you're on this journey with us.